Welcome to the Omfit podcast. Thank you for tuning into this podcast in the series Ahead of the ECB, analysing where we are and likely scenarios for the monetary policy announcement made by the ECB this month. And as well as going into thoughts on the strategy review, I'm Ellie Groves from Omfif, and I'm very pleased to be joined by Ian Begg, Professor Research Fellow at the European Institute, London School of Economics and Political Science, and Silvia D'Angelo, Senior Economist at Federated Hermes Investment Management. Before we do talk about the September announcement, I'm going to ask each of you to focus a little bit on the strategy review. As mentioned, we would go into this as it forms the large context in how we are operating and what the ECB will be discussing in September. Do you think that the June announcement and change to the 2% target went far enough to address the structural growth issues in Europe and wider to give the ECB enough movement to calm the markets and to really look at the focus on inflation that perhaps is needed post-COVID?
Trying to second guess what was intended with the strategy review is an enormous question. And all of us have struggled with trying to work out what was behind the thinking of it. I detect in economic terms, and I'm going to come on to political in a moment, two broad rationales for it. One is that if you look at the performance of inflation over the best part of the last decade, it's been well below the 2%, or close to 2% implicit target that was there in the previous monetary policy strategy. Clearly, a motivation for the new approach was to anchor inflation expectations at 2%, to say to the market, to other actors in the system, you should expect inflation to be 2% and plan accordingly. And that then puts the onus on the central bank, European Central Bank in this case, to find ways of reaching that 2% target. Now, by making it symmetrical, in other words, similar to the Bank of England and a number of other central banks, and saying deviations above and below will be regarded as equally undesirable. What's happened in practice is that the European Central Bank is joining the family of central banks, which regards 2% as the long run target and no longer allowing for undershooting. Now, in economic terms, that can be interpreted as saying that the European Central Bank is shifting away from what some at least perceived as a deflationary bias in their previous approach. So that's one economic interpretation. The other is that there is this constant battle between monetary policy and fiscal and other policies about who does what, particularly in a context of severe crisis such as the pandemic brought in. And what I detect in this also is that central bank is setting out its stall and saying, here's what we can do to contribute to a different approach to economic governance generally, to the policy mix. And that motivates the shifts in tone, the shift to a symmetric target, saying that we will do something to try to catch up if inflation undershoots, which is a very provocative element as seen particularly in the what you call the hot countries. So there's a big change there. Now, does it go far enough? Well, it turns the European Central Bank into what I think Martin Sandbu in the Financial Times called a more normal central bank. But it probably went as far as was politically possible. So it's almost idle to speculate on what more could have been done, because that was the limit of the reconciliation of the different factions within the governing council. So it's all very well to look elsewhere and say, you could have done this, you could have done that. But there simply wasn't the weight in the governing council to go either further or less far.
Thank you. Silvia, do you have further thoughts on the June announcement, so this on the strategy review? And also for the markets, was this target change and accompanying explanation welcomed? Did it go far enough? So I think Ian did touch on that it brings the ECB in line with other central banks, but not quite as far as the Fed. It wasn't quite as explicit on its asymmetrical target explanation as the Fed had been.
Yeah, so from a market perspective, really the announcement was much ado about nothing, or about little at least. The adjustment of the inflation target to 2% was hardly surprising. And as Ian said, it really made the ECB more normal and more normal central bank. We were symmetric target, and basically seeing both positive and negative deviation from target as equally undesirable. However, of course, there was little clarity about how the ECB will achieve its new inflation target. And really the discussion about the available tools was scant, to say the least. Also, I would add that the ECB fell short of adopting a formal makeup strategy. That was, again, hardly surprising because communication going into the announcement of the outcome of the strategy review basically suggested that the adoption of a makeup strategy was really far-fetched for the ECB. But again, I think it undermined, in a way, the perception of the determination of the ECB to achieve its inflation target. And it was at odds with what the Fed had done roughly a year earlier. And finally, in terms of novelties in the strategy review, the ECB's commitment to take into account the implication of climate change for monetary policy was also somewhat feeble, as clearly at this stage it's mainly considering the climate change as a risk to financial stability, and that is hardly a groundbreaking approach. So overall, I'd say a fairly underwhelming outcome of the strategy review. But that said, I also think that the ECB has been overburdened over the last decade or so with tasks that should be addressed by other policymakers. And so you mentioned this this target of addressing structural growth issues. I doubt that that is something for the ECB to address. And really, governments should take up the biggest challenges of our times. For European governments, it's about European integration. It's also about trying to lift what is now sluggish productivity growth everywhere in Europe. Of course, regional and social inequalities, addressing regional and social inequalities, and also addressing the looming climate crisis.
Thank you. I want to mention the climate crisis and come back to you, Ian, in a recent article that you have written, but I think you wanted to come in a little bit more on the strategy review first. So if you want to expand on some of the points that you mentioned and also in response to Sylvia, please do so.
Well, three quick points. So the first is that Sylvia is correct. The ECB has been on quite a journey over the last 15 years. Now, if you look back to the previous monetary policy review, strategy review in 2003, look at what has happened to monetary policy under an outline of what was going to happen set in a far distant epoch of 2003. So many things have been done under the existing strategy that takes me to my second point, that although we can focus on what's written in the strategy and say it's disappointing, it doesn't make anybody jump up and down with excitement, what will matter is implementation, how it's used. And there are noticeable, this is my third point, noticeable vague points in it, such as we don't know what the margins that the ECB will work to in saying the deviation downwards or upwards will be. The Bank of England is very clear in this, because it's a mandate set by the government, plus or minus one percentage point. Even the Fed goes a little bit further in giving indications of when it will act and when it won't. But what we don't know is when strategy turns to implementation, where the margins will start to bite.
Thank you. I want to go on to that a little bit later, potentially, but I also want to touch on some of the other conversations that Sylvia brought up or started to tease out with the issue of climate and climate change. Ian, you have written recently on the shift from central banks, or the shift for central banks to move towards what was traditionally seen as more political areas, the ESG agenda being one of them. The NGFS is obviously gearing up even further and really taking off. And the central banks are moving into tackling climate change in more explicit terms. Could you please outline the positives and risks of this as you see them?
Central banks cannot claim just to be technocrats. What they do has effects much wider than just price stability. That's an important starting point, because anyone can say anytime what the central bank just did or just did not do is also a political decision. It's true if you engage in what we've seen over recent years, the massive programs of asset purchases of different sorts, because they will make it easier for countries with a very high debt to cope with the high debt and make it more difficult for countries with low debt to reward the savers. So these are political decisions always. Now, when you come to something like climate change, there are many, particularly in Germany, who say, what is the ECB doing meddling in climate change? It's not their business. They should be concentrating on the core monetary policy objectives. But climate change comes into the story in two respects. The first is that if you have risks associated with climate change and they turn into financial risks, financial stability is something that could be affected by the way climate change or the answers to climate change evolve. And the second is that when you start to talk about financial stability, it does have an effect on how you view supervision of banks. Are banks investing in the appropriate manner? Now, what the ECB is not apparently so far willing to do is to go so far as the Bank of England in considering biasing its purchases of assets towards those that are, in inverted commas, green. That would be a very strong signal, something the ECB's stopped short of. But it's something that's going to be on the table, because if you want to change behavior, central banks can play a role in changing behavior. It has risks. We know that Mark Carney was a strong advocate of this, and that Andrew Bailey at the Bank of England has continued that tradition. But as soon as central banks get into this territory, you're going to provoke backlashes from those who say central banks should be just limited to their narrow role. So it's a very tricky area overall, and it's about the balances of behaviour in different contexts.
Thank you. Scilla, do you have anything to add from your perspective on central banks taking on more of a role within the climate agenda?
Well, as I said earlier, most central banks, including the ECB, have taken the route of seeing climate change as a risk to financial stability. And financial stability is within the mandate of central banks. So I think it's a very elegant way to address the issue. But of course, it's hardly a groundbreaking approach, and the challenge is such that it calls for more forceful action. Possible way, as also suggested by Ian, would be to incorporate climate change considerations in corporate purchasing programs, something that the Bank of England has already done. But then, as I also said earlier, other policymakers probably have to be more involved and more forceful in tackling the climate crisis. And central banks probably have more of a policy advocacy role to play.
I want to bring the conversation back a little bit more to the September and what we expect to hear in September. Both the President Biden from the Bundesbank and Philip Lane from the ECB have spoken about the PEP program recently and indicated the phasing out in March 2022 is obviously where we are currently as the expectation for the end of PEPP, but there has been some speculation that this will be continued for 3 months further, or that it will be folded into other asset purchase programs that the ECB has, and that some of the structural conditions around it will be put into other QE programs. And then there's also, I believe Philip Lane has spoken from the ECB, has spoken about that September will be actually too early to have any definitive answer to 2022's phase out of the QE program, the PEPP, because of the unknowns of the pandemic. What are your expectations for September? Do you think that the hawks or the doves, if we are going to be quite a clear in the definitions that we have, crude perhaps in our definitions, but the hawks or the doves, which one has President Lagarde's ear, do you think? And what do we expect from the September announcement?
First point to make is that this is only the second meeting since the strategy review. So if you were to push me for a direct answer to your question, what's going to happen? My favorite word is likely to be nothing. But you talk about an apparent conflict or a difference of perspective between Jens Weidmann and Philip Lane. If you allow me to say so, I think Omfif is inclined to look just too much at Germany. And it is important to recognize that there are very strong voices. And I'm thinking here particularly of François Villeroy de Galou and Pablo Hernandez de Cos, who are representative of a different strand within the governing council. And in this context, I think it's important to realize the extent of the concerns in much of Southern Europe about too early a move away from stimulus in general, monetary stimulus in particular, but stimulus in general to the economy. So in this regard, if to anticipate another part of the question you're asking, should we be moving away from the PEP to the asset purchase program? Here I'm going to make a play on words on PEP. I think it's about asking whether do you prefer Pepsi or Coke. There isn't that great a difference macroeconomically. Now, it may be that there are some distributive consequences of opting for one purchase program over another. But I don't see purchase programs in general being reined back anytime soon. And to me, macroeconomically, it doesn't make a great difference which one you use. It may make a difference to some of the Southern European countries if it's a shift from PEP to APP. But I don't think it'd be a particularly radical difference. I know I'm being a tad provocative in what I'm saying here now.
No, that's wonderful. And I would say that from the conversations that Omfif has had, we would be inclined to also agree. We do have the Banque de France in our meetings quite frequently and in our conversations, and also the Bank of Greece as well, Hernando de Cos as well, we engage with. So I would come back for that, but I do think that you make a good point with the Bundesbank and Philip Lane comparison. My question was also meant to very much look at the doves, all those Southern European countries as well. So thank you for that. I think it was very comprehensive and helpful.
Don't equate them too narrowly, because there are shades of opinion. And to use an expression invented by the infamous Richard Nixon, there is a silent majority. It doesn't get much play outside the governing council.
I think that is an extremely good point, and thank you for making it. And we should all be aware of it. So thank you, Ian. I fully agree with that as well. And the difference of opinions depending on what aspect of monetary policy you're talking about, I think is, and which tool you are speaking of, I think is really important as well to consider. Sylvia, do you have anything to add there as well on, from the market's perspective, what you think will, what you expect to happen in September, and what would be potentially helpful or not within the markets?
So I think that the markets would really focus on the discussion of the prospects for PEP. So despite the fact that probably other issues such as policy setting that is more adapt to achieve the new inflation target are probably more relevant from an economic point of view, the market typically focuses on more short-term issues. And clearly the PEP and its expiry in March 2022 is front and center. I think it is way too early to discuss the future of the PEP at this stage. There are different views within the governing councils, as already discussed, and in terms of QE, I think that that divergences are probably more pronounced, with doves in the governing council arguing for more, and hawks, especially from northern countries, more skeptical really about the benefits of more QE. That said, at the moment, the pandemic is still ongoing. So the PEP really is a purchasing program that is linked to the evolution of the pandemic. And so I think that the ECB will wait for more information about the evolution of the virus, the importance of the Delta variant and how it affects the outlook, in order to provide more clarity about the future of the PEP. As it stands, I think that the ECB will continue to buy purchases at a sustained pace, and that basically more generally QE is here to stay, given that other policy tools, and in particular the policy rate, are constrained.
Thank you. Ian, I want to ask you a question. It's a comparative question. Do you think that President Lagarde has gone further than perhaps President Draghi did on ensuring consensus within the governing council? So obviously you tease out the conflicting opinions and thoughts between each of the members of the governing council, which are all extremely important to address and understand. But there does seem to be that there was a consensus in June on the strategy review, or at least the narrow part of the strategy review that was brought out and spoken about. And then obviously you've seen some divergence and some differences coming out from the monetary policy announcements that have happened, but the two that have happened since. But do you think that there still seems to be quite a lot of consensus and goodwill within the governing council? Do you think that that is a difference between President Draghi, or just a difference in how it's being presented?
It's very hard for us to tell because they're Trappists. We don't know what they say. But, I mean, the proper Trappist, they wouldn't say anything at all in public. But I think what we can detect in this is that the image that's coming over, the communication, is one which tries very hard to emphasize agreements rather than disagreements. You saw that at the July 22nd meeting, where there was manifestly disagreement about the nature of the forward guidance. And it came out a little bit during the press conference when Christine Lagarde was cross-examined about it. So what? I mean, you'd expect a degree of disagreement on something as far-reaching as forward guidance. And the big story is still that somehow the governing council was persuaded to adopt the strategy review. And I go back to something I said earlier. I think that the test for it will come during implementation, when a strategy gives quite a lot of room for manoeuvre. As I said previously, we saw that between 2003 and the July revision this year. It's how that room for manoeuvre is used and what the balances of power are. So possibly, yes, Mario Draghi was forceful, and it can be argued that Lagarde has been a bit more emollient, particularly towards the German side or the Nordic side. I'm very, very sceptical of the use of the term hawks, because I don't see them as being so easy to categorise. But it's more continuity than it is change.
I get the impression, and I hope you don't mind me summarising that, that is still to watch, though. It seems to be relatively... No, I mean, it's still difficult, I'm sure, but there can be a consensus around an idea of something. Whereas when that puts into practice and the implementation, it seems that I think that you're sort of suggesting that will be the challenging part of the disagreement or agreements.
Well, yes, suppose inflation drops again and reverts to this 10-year trend of being around 1%, then big decisions will have to be taken. Exactly. How do you get inflation up again? The central bank toolkit of raising inflation hasn't been proven yet. And that's going to be a big question of implementation, because with the new commitment, they ought to act, to use the expression in the review, forcefully.
Exactly. And Sylvia, I want to also ask you about something you were talking about at the beginning on the fiscal and monetary policy interplay. What would you expect to see from governments as well, and from the fiscal, looking at structural growth in Europe? How do you think that the governments can be supporting this?
Well, I think that at the moment, the next big challenge for government is to adopt a new set of fiscal rules that basically accommodate the needs of each single country and favor some sort of convergence across the Eurozone. I think that the crisis, it was a tragedy really, but it also offered an opportunity to really revisit the fiscal framework in the European Union, and specifically in the Eurozone, as basically that's where there is a common currency that needs to be underpinned by closer fiscal integration. First of all, the EU Recovery Fund really offered a new blueprint in order to issue common debt across the Eurozone. It's unlikely that it will be adopted straight away for other form of spending, but clearly the blueprint is there, and when the next crisis hits, or you know, to tackle some existential challenges like the climate change, I think that that blueprint can be used again, and that's really a big change. In the meantime, as I said, the discussion on a new set of rules will probably take the best part of next year once we have the results of the German and French elections. And again, it's promising to in terms of building further the European project and enhancing fiscal integration, which is still missing at the moment.
Thank you very much. Ian, do you have something you would like to add on the next gen EU? This is slightly moving away from ahead of the ECB. I am aware of that, but I think these things do not operate in a vacuum. So it is important to look at Europe as a whole. So Ian, please do.
On the contrary, I think it's quite close to what the ECB is doing, because to take up a point Sylvia made earlier, the ECB has done too much of the heavy lifting in responding not just to the pandemic, but even more so to the sovereign debt crisis and the aftermath of, going back even further, the global financial crisis. We do have this new instrument, the Recovery and Resilience Facility, part of the Next Generation EU. It is not the conventional fiscal stimulus. It's not what has been enacted in the US, for example. But it is starting to come on stream. National plans have been approved and the money will start to flow. And that is going to change the environment by giving the potential for fiscal stimulus a boost in some of the countries which are receiving the biggest amounts. And that in turn takes pressure off monetary policy. So there is quite a close connection in all this.
Also, if I might chip in, one positive aspect of the European Recovery Fund is that funds are also conditional on structural reforms. So you should have like a joint benefit of having funding, common funding, and structural reforms at the same time. And also it ticks all the right boxes in terms of infrastructure projects, addressing the climate change crisis. And so there are at least 30% of the funds should be devoted to green the economy. So it provides like a nice blueprint for further fiscal initiatives going forward.
I think we should all be wishing the best of luck to Mario Draghi in making that happen. So in my best Italian, in bocca al lupo.
Absolutely. Implementation is really tricky there.
So I think we will be drawing to a close now, but I think it's been a really interesting discussion where we started on the strategy review, spoke about what is likely to happen in September, although Ian's prediction of probably nothing. Sylvia, you didn't quite answer that one, so I'll go to you directly. What do you think will be the headline of September for the ECB?
Well, I think the focus will be on the review of the PEP, so you know, the calibration and implementation of the programme. The hawks have a case there, because it's true that financial conditions have eased in recent months, so since the June meeting when the last review of the programme took place. And so we've seen like yields coming down, the euro weakening, also stronger stocks. At the same time, the September meeting will also offer a new set of forecasts, and they might show some upgrades, at least in the short term. But that really mainly reflects some backward-looking developments, and so a stronger than expected GDP print in the second quarter of this year. However, at the same time, risks have also intensified, I'd say. And so we've seen the COVID Delta variant, supply constraints holding back production at a global level, really. And a bit of a slowdown everywhere, and especially in China, where the recent regulatory push is probably having a dent on growth. So there are higher risks. And despite the fact that the hawks will probably try to put together a case for a slower pace of purchases within the PEP program, I think that purchases will continue at a fast pace. Recently, the ECB has voted about 17 to 18 billion euros per week. And I think that they have space, they have room to continue until the end of the program in March 2022. So I broadly agree with Ian that there will probably nothing out of this meeting. Although there is a chance, as I said, for the hawks to make the case for a slower pace of purchasing because of easier financial conditions in the last few months.
Thank you very much. I think that in summary, we still have a lot to watch. I think we should also see how the next generation EU plays out with its implementation. And the key will be when the ECB needs to implement the strategy review or changes that the strategy review brings up in their toolkit. And I think that is hugely predicated on inflation, which is still an unknown due to COVID-19. And there still seems to be quite a few unknowns that may come up. So I hope that that's a crude, if not eloquent, summary of a very interesting and in-depth conversation that we've had. So thank you all for listening, and thank you, Ian and Sylvia, for joining us. We will be continuing these ahead of the ECB podcasts as we look at what the ECB is doing towards the end of 2021 and into 2022 and beyond. It is a regular feature at OnFifth. So thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to seeing what comes next. Thank you for listening to the OnFifth podcast.